Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President-elect Donald Trump is voicing new doubts that Russian hackers were behind an effort to influence last November's U.S. election. His latest tweeted comments followed a broadcast denial by WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange that Moscow was behind documents from the Democratic National Committee that his group made public during the campaign. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the issue pits the president-elect and Assange against an array of U.S. intelligence agencies and others.
On one hand, you've got the Russians and the aforementioned Mr. Assange. On the other side, you've got the 17 intelligence agencies of the United States government, outside cyber experts that have taken a look at this situation. You've got Democrats on Capitol Hill. You've got Republicans on Capitol Hill. And at least one advisor to Mr. Trump expressing concern about Russia's malicious activity in cyberspace in the context of the election.
A Senate hearing on the matter is scheduled later Thursday. Vice President-elect Mike Pence Wednesday defended Mr. Trump, who has voiced a very sincere, he said, and healthy skepticism of the conclusions of the intelligence community. Mr. Trump scheduled to receive an intelligence briefing on the matter Friday. Gambia's army chief Wednesday pledged allegiance to President Yahya Jammeh, who has refused to accept defeat following the December 1st election that the Election Commission said was won by opposition leader Adama Barrow. In a published New Year's message, Lieutenant General Usman Baji said Mr. Jammeh had the unflinching loyalty of the Gambian Armed Forces. Mr. Jammeh, who originally accepted defeat, is under pressure from the West African bloc ECOWAS to leave office. His mandate is to end January 19th. The ruling party is asking the nation's Supreme Court to nullify the election results. This is VOA News. Turkey says it has established the identity of the New Year's Day gunman who walked into an Istanbul nightclub, killing 39 patrons, most of them foreigners, and fleeing. Police have detained suspected members of Islamic State, which claim responsibility for the attack. The attacker, who remains at large, has not been publicly named. In his first public remarks since the mass shooting, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said, as we enter the excitement of a new year, terror has targeted our country in the lowliest, most treacherous and insidious of ways. The U.S.-led coalition has doubled to 450, the number of advisors assisting Iraqi forces fighting Islamic State fighters. U.S. Air Force Colonel John Dorian discussed their role Wednesday from coalition headquarters in Baghdad.
To help advise them as they move forward and to synchronize operations. The Iraqis have taken advantage of that, and that's been effective.
He said the recent deployment comes as phase two involving synchronized attacks from three directions in the Battle of Mosul against its Islamic State defenders get underway.
What we're finding is that the synchronized attacks present the enemy with more problems than they can solve, and the Iraqi security forces are making progress with the continued benefit of coalition strikes and advisors.
There are nearly 5,000 American military personnel in Iraq. An Israeli military court Wednesday convicted a young soldier of manslaughter for shooting to death a wounded Palestinian who stabbed an Israeli soldier during unrest in Hebron in the occupied territories last March. The conviction has prompted calls for Sergeant Elor Azaria's pardon, including from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Regional analyst Joseph Olmert of the University of South Carolina said the incident occurred amid lingering tensions during a spate of Palestinian attacks on Israelis, but the decision of the court, he said, has to be respected.
Part of the defense of the soldier was about the overall atmosphere surrounding the case, whereas the military authorities, when they decided to put him to trial, looked at the situation only from the perspective of him disobeying the standing orders of the army and doing something that should not have been done.
The case has drawn international attention. Palestinian and some rights groups are accusing the Israeli military of using excessive force against lightly armed assailants. The UN Security Council Wednesday unanimously called for rapid and thorough implementation of a political agreement aimed at defusing the crisis over the presidency in Democratic Republic of Congo. Under the Catholic Church-mediated deal, incumbent Joseph Kabila has committed to stepping down at year's end when new elections are held. President-elect Trump Wednesday spoke by phone with newly installed UN Chief Antonio Guterres in what a UN spokesman called a very positive discussion on U.S.-UN relations. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. DRC Catholic bishops urge international acceptance and support for their mediation efforts.
The bishops wanted that this new agreement be encouraged and accepted by the international community, like the African Union and the United States.
Abbe Donatien Unchale is the first Deputy Secretary General of the National Episcopal Conference of Congo. Kenya's biometric voter technology raises fears of vote manipulation. The number of refugees in Cameroon and their needs continue to grow. South Sudan refugees in Uganda take up farming to supplement their aid. And a trip by a South African opposition politician to Taiwan exposes cracks in South Africa's foreign policy.
Business people from South Africa visit Taipei to pursue trade and investment opportunities. There's nothing wrong with it, and China would not oppose that sort of thing.
Klisi Moyale is a spokesman for the South African Foreign Ministry, and the next generation malaria vaccine is shown to be highly effective. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An official of the Catholic Bishops' Conference in the Democratic Republic of Congo is calling on the international community to encourage and accept the group's mediation effort, particularly the New Year's Eve agreement to end political bickering and violence in the country. The deal calls for President Joseph Kabila to stay in power until elections are held at the end of next year. It also calls for the creation of a transitional government to be headed by the main opposition coalition known as the Rassemblement. On Wednesday, the bishops met with President Joseph Kabila. Abbe Donatien Unchale, first Deputy Secretary General of the National Episcopal Conference of Congo, Noah Senko, says President Kabila encouraged the bishops to keep working until the agreement is fully implemented.
The President Kabila asked the bishops to continue with the second part of the agreement because he refused the first part, and the bishops told him that they have to go on for the second part, and the President Kabila agreed.
The agreement calls for election and that President Kabila will not participate or he will step down after the election. Did the president agree to that?
The presidential election is programmed on December 2017. This is after a year.
So what are you going to do next with the mediation?
Not because the agreement, the first part of the agreement as the general now, they have to precise the clean agreement when the first minister will be nominated. And how the National Council of the Transition will be organized.
Mr. Unchale, some political parties in the DRC did not sign the agreement. What do you want to say to them?
The mediation is going on until now. And the mediation will be present in the National Council. We will be encouraged to follow the application of the agreement.
How did the church manage to succeed where the African Union did not, I would say, succeed in the negotiations?
The African Union encouraged the application of this agreement. The African Union wasn't able to put together the radical opposition. Now the bishops are putting together all parts of the politics out to find solution of this political crisis.
Now, what's the next thing? Are you waiting for the different parties to form a unity government, or are you going to be continuing to mediate?
Yes, the bishops are continuing to mediate because this second part, the political actors have to put on the details of the agreement, principally about the government.
So you will be encouraging the different parties to put together a government?
Yes, because in the first part, the agreement said that the government will be dirigible by the opposition. But now, when the new government will start, it is not precise. And what will be the profile of the new government, and what will be the work of the Council National to follow the application of this accord, that will be not precise, that will be the second part.
What do the bishops need to help you to do your work better? Do you need any financial assistance from the government, from the United Nations, or from the African Union?
The bishops want that this new agreement be encouraged and accepted by the international community, like the African Union and the United States. The bishops want that the international community to encourage all teams to negate this agreement.
Abbe Donatien Nshale is the first Deputy Secretary General of the National Episcopal Conference of Congo. He was speaking with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. Kenya's Electoral Commission says political wrangles and tension related to biometric voter technology may delay preparations for the country's upcoming elections. As Mohamed Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi, the opposition is threatening protest over a proposed amendment to Kenya's electoral law.
Kenya's Senate Legal Committee is reviewing public comments about a controversial amendment to the electoral law the lower house passed late last month. The bill will allow manual voting and also allow the commission to manually submit election results in case biometric voter technology fails during the August election. Electoral commissioners said they requested the amendment because they do not want to lock out some voters who may not be identified by their biometric registration kits. Former Council of Governors Chairman Bomet County Governor Isaac Ruto told the Senate Legal Committee the manual system could be manipulated.
Out there, Kenyans just want fairness. They are not interested in tyranny of your numbers inside the houses. The real issue is the voters who don't turn up, and we end up voting for them manually, identifying them manually.
This is not the only Electoral Commission request that has been challenged. A Kenyan court stopped the electoral body from awarding a bid to auditing firm KPMG to clean the voter register. The court also suspended 25 million tender for printing ballot papers given to a Dubai-based company, saying the bid was marred with irregularities. Electoral Commission Deputy Head Betty Nyabuto says political players are making preparations for the election difficult.
I think we are largely very prepared for this election. I really don't see any huge challenge. The huge challenge would basically be out there with the external players. They need to give us that operational space for us as a commission to do our work.
Political commentators Martin Andati wants any quick fixes to the electoral process may result in post-election violence.
If you are doing amendments haphazardly the way we are doing, we are bound to have problems during the voting time. So that will cause a problem. And if we don't have a credible and accepted election, then we are bound to have chaos.
The electoral body plans a mass voter registration from January 16th to February 14th. The registration activities may be affected by opposition plans to start street protests if the Senate passes the electoral law amendments. The Senate is to meet Thursday to debate the amendments and vote on the recommendations from the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 5th. Let's send shout-outs to listeners on our affiliate stations in Uganda, Kenya, and Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. Controversy around a South African opposition politician's recent visit to Taiwan does not appear to be dying down. In fact, it has exposed cracks in South Africa's government. South Africa enjoys strong relations with China and adheres to a one-China policy and says this trip by the mayor of Pretoria challenges South Africa's unified stance on China. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
A recent visit to Taiwan by a top South African opposition party mayor has stirred debate and sparked a power struggle within the government in Pretoria. Until recently, most of South Africa's local government posts were held by the long-ruling African National Congress, which had held a virtual lock on policy from City Hall to the presidency. One of its strongest foreign policy tenets is maintaining a strong relationship with China, which says Taiwan is part of China. This one China policy has led many countries, including the United States and South Africa, to not officially recognize Taiwan. Now that staunch policy is being shaken from the bottom levels of South African government. In last year's municipal polls, the Democratic Alliance snatched three powerful executive mayoralties. One of those mayors, Pretoria's Solly Msimanga, went to Taiwan last month to meet Taipei's pro-independence mayor and look at business opportunities. While there, he accepted a key to the city. That, says South Africa Foreign Ministry spokesman Clayson Monyela, crossed a line.
Business people from South Africa visit Taipei to pursue trade and investment opportunities. We've also done that from government. There's nothing wrong with it, and China would not oppose that sort of thing. But when it has political undertones that seek to undermine the One China policy, that's where the difficulty arises.
Ms. Imanga's party says the ANC-dominated government is using this trip as a political football. Parliament member Dean McPherson says when he visited Taiwan as part of a delegation of opposition MPs, just 3 weeks before Ms. Imanga's trip, he was warmly welcomed by officials from the South African liaison office.
I think that this is nothing but hypocrisy and cheap political point scoring at its absolute worst. And what it's done is that it is, I think, correctly opened the debate in South Africa about who can and can't dictate to our different spheres of government who they should be talking to attract investment when we have 9 million unemployed South Africans.
Researcher Rudolf Duplessis of the South African Institute of International Affairs says this debate is unlikely to change South African policy on China. But he notes as China continues to invest in Africa and Taiwan rapidly loses allies on the continent, most recently the West African island of Sao Tome, Taiwan may be changing tack.
The fact that Taiwan's traditional diplomatic footprint is growing smaller each year, it might indicate a shift on Taiwan's part towards more, you know, city-to-city contacts. And I think Solly Msimanga in that case might be quite a good candidate to promote that system of diplomacy.
In a stern yet vague statement, President Jacob Zuma said he had noted the controversy and would soon convene a group of top local and provincial leaders to encourage cooperation among different levels of government. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Humanitarian challenges continue to mount in Cameroon as refugees continue to flow in from Nigeria and the Central African Republic. The government and the United Nations are concerned about acute food shortages in the year to come. Moki Edwin Kinzeka has the story for VOA from Yaoundé.
The number of officially registered refugees in Cameroon has climbed to about 500,000. With fresh arrivals coming from both Nigeria and the Central African Republic. That's in addition to the over 200,000 people registered as internally displaced by the Boko Haram conflict. But Najat Rushdie, coordinator of United Nations aid efforts in Cameroon, says the acute numbers of refugees and displaced people are much higher. Some people are still being registered, while others have sought shelter outside of camps. The UN estimates the total number of refugees and displaced people in Cameroon to be as many as 1.6 million and warns that the number could climb to as high as 2.7 million. But the government and the UN say $310 million is needed over the next 3 years to meet the needs.
La grande inquiétude que nous avons et le grand changement en termes d'évolution.
She says the highest worry is the increasing number of people vulnerable to food insecurity and malnutrition, since more than 2 million people are already exposed to food insecurity. She says on Cameroon's northern border, where Nigerian refugees are found, there have been unpredictable long dry seasons, floods and unfavorable climate conditions that have hurt farmers. She says such factors are having direct impacts on the humanitarian situation of refugees and displaced persons, so they have to look for means to handle it now. armed groups continue to operate freely in the Central African Republic, in particular in the countryside. Not only do refugees not want to return home, but as many as 20,000 more have arrived in the past 10 months. And Cameroonian authorities have warned that despite recent military successes against Boko Haram, the war against the terrorists is not over. Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration, René Emmanuel Sadi, says host populations near the border with Nigeria are abandoning their farms for fear of insurgent attacks. That has aggravated the food crisis.
Nous avons à nouveau pensé mettre en place un plan de réponse.
He says Cameroon is counting on international donors, friendly countries and the UN to execute the emergency response plan it has prepared to take care of both refugees and internally displaced persons. The Boko Haram insurgency, now in its 8th year, has spilled over to Cameroon, Chad and Niger. According to the United Nations, more than 25,000 people have lost their lives and over 2 million have been displaced. Moki, Edwin Kinzuka, for VOA News, Yaoundé.
South Sudanese who fled conflict in their country and sought refuge in Uganda's Bidibidi refugee camp are setting up small-scale business enterprises in the camp to supplement the aid they receive from relief agencies. The refugees say the aid they receive is too little to sustain their families. They are asking non-profit organizations to provide them with loans so that they can expand their businesses. Tito Justin has the story for VOA from Juba.
South Sudanese refugees in northern Uganda's Yumbe district say the food they get from the UN World Food Program is not enough to sustain their families, so they are doing what they can to earn some money. Odama Eli Anga used it to sell second-hand clothes in Yei River State before he fled the area last year. Recently, Eli bought a sewing machine, which he hopes will enable him to sew clothes and sell them in the camp. Eli earns about 100,000 Ugandan shillings, or about $30 a day, by selling second-hand clothes in the camp. He says he used to earn over $100 a day doing the same business in Yei River State, where running his business was easier.
Every resource is there. You can buy more than two types of clothes. Business is okay. But here, only one type. Sometimes, if people did not come to buy, you will continue to stay like that until when they also come and they buy. The problem here is only capital. Capital is not enough because we used this money for transport since coming from South Sudan.
Eli says he earns some money to supplement what he gets from the UN share. He encourages other refugees to think of some of small enterprise they can run.
Yeah, my business helps me mostly. I can able to acquire other things from the market since the type of source given to us is only beans. I am now currently with my business. I'm able to buy sweet potatoes in the market to be boiled for taking tea. Though the capital is little, but it is helping me.
Sarah Tete was separated from her husband and she fled to Bidibidi settlement camp with her 7 children. She says she feels like a widow since she doesn't know the whereabouts of her husband. Tete was a retail trader in Yei River State, Morobo County. Now she sells vegetables in Bidibidi settlement camp. Tete says she earns around $1 a day and uses the money to help her children. Speaking in her Keliko language, Tete says the money she earns is not even enough to cater for her children's needs.
I use the money for buying sugar and small fish, and it's not enough to buy even meat because the money is little and our demands are too many.
Mary Nyoka fled Yei River State, Lanya County, with her children. She lives in Bidibidi camp, but her children are in Rhino refugee settlement. Speaking in her local Pojulu language, Nyoka says she would like to get a loan to expand her business of selling cassava flour and other items such as onions and tomatoes.
You know this business? I came with little money and I'm buying the cassava flour just to help me, but the money is not enough. Like in a day, I only get 4,000 shillings.
That's about $1.5. Nyoka says she needs the extra money to buy salt and soap and will continue her business because very little bit helps. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
A genetically engineered malaria vaccine has been shown to prevent the disease in mice. The vaccine, poised for clinical trials later this year, has the potential to halt transmission of the mosquito-borne illness, VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
An estimated 212 million people are infected with malaria every year, according to the most recent statistics from the World Health Organization, and 429,000, mostly children in sub-Saharan Africa, die of the disease, which is transmitted by mosquitoes. The parasite that causes malaria, P. falciparum, is front and center of a next-generation vaccine that has the potential to prevent the disease and halt transmission. Researchers at the Center for Infectious Disease Research at the University of Washington in Seattle, in conjunction with the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center, have developed a vaccine that uses the entire parasite to stimulate a protective immune response. Stefan Kappa is director of translational research at the center. He says researchers weakened the live parasite by knocking out three genes that promote infection after the parasite enters the liver. Kappa calls that first stage of the disease the gateway of malaria infection.
These three genes make sure that the parasite cannot develop to the next stage of infection, which occurs in the blood, which causes all the disease and death associated with malaria.
Normally, after the parasite infects the liver, it leaves the organ to infect red blood cells, where billions of disease-causing parasites are produced. In a study reported in the journal Science Translational Medicine, researchers describe identifying the three genes tucked within the parasite's enormous genome that allow falciparum to enter the bloodstream. By knocking them out, the altered parasite remained confined to the liver, according to Kappa, and the immune system began churning out protective antibodies.
So it infects the liver, that's asymptomatic, so that's okay, and it doesn't cause any specific damage to the liver, but it stimulates your immune system. So it stops right there, and we call it check-in, but doesn't check out.
In a phase one clinical trial testing the vaccine's safety, the neutralized parasite was injected into 10 healthy volunteers, showing that it stimulated a strong immune response without making the participants sick. Investigators then injected mice with the genetically engineered parasites and exposed them to parasites that had not been altered. The vaccine containing the parasite minus the three genes completely protected the animals from malaria, and Kappa says it has the potential to prevent person-to-person transmission.
If you block the parasite in the liver, you do not get disease, but you also don't get transmission of the parasite to the next person because the mosquito has to pick up parasites from the bloodstream. But if the parasite can never make it to the bloodstream, it cannot be transmitted to another person.
Researchers are preparing to test the experimental vaccine in humans later this year to see whether they, too, are protected against malaria when exposed to the parasite. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Thursday, January 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Bedford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryer, I'm James Bott in Washington wishing you in Africa a good Thursday.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou will discuss New Year's resolution, how to stay motivated and take some important prevention steps for good health in 2017. With guest Dr. Paul Jenny Edo, Head of Clinical Services, Kosawa Polyclinic in Ghana. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOAF.